Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Hi, and welcome to the second bonus episode of History of Portugal. On this episode, I had the opportunity to speak with Professor Roger Collins. He is a British medievalist, currently an honorary fellow in history at the University of Edinburgh. Collins studied at the University of Oxford, both Queen's and St. Cross Colleges. He then taught ancient and medieval history at the universities of Liverpool and Bristol. He then arrived at the University of Edinburgh in 1994 and joined the Institute of Advanced Studies in the Humanities before becoming an honorary fellow in the School of History, Classics and Archaeology in 1998. He is the author of 8 books on the early medieval history of the Iberian Peninsula, as well as others on the wider history of Europe in those centuries and on the history of the papacy, from St. Peter to St. Benedict XVI. Some of my personal favorites that I use for the show include such titles as Early Medieval Spain, Unity in Diversity, The Arab Conquest of Spain, Visigothic Spain, Medieval Spain, Culture, Conflict, and Coexistence, and the title that I'm using for the past few episodes, Caliphs and Kings. His current book project is titled The Christian Culture of Islamic Spain, Origins, Survival, and Rediscovery. So today's topic, well, one of the topics that I wanted to talk about is the term of Reconquista. It's a term that, as far as I've seen, it's a bit of a polemic. It's different historians have different takes on whether that term is useful or if it's damaging to our understanding of the period, since it's apparently used a bit later on and not necessarily during the time. And I would just like to hear your thoughts, your initial thoughts on the term Reconquista.
Well, I suppose it's a term that's got a lot of kind of political baggage nowadays. As far as I know, it first appears, you know, other terms were used before, but I think it first appears in the early 19th century, and indeed it may emerge out of the context of resistance to Napoleonic conquest and the French occupation of Spain in the very beginning of the 19th century. But it then kind of gets used a lot more intensively in kind of scholarly discourse in the 19th century and is then adopted very strongly by the Franco regime as a way of presenting an authoritative history of Spain in the Middle Ages in terms of this kind of recovery, that, if you like, the expulsion of the non-Hispanic elements and the recovery of the true Spain as it were, the united, politically united, religiously united Catholic Spain, which was very much a kind of feature of the self-presentation of the Franco government. And it's really only after that it began to be questioned fairly intensively as to whether this is the best way of looking at the history of medieval Spain, and indeed whether the whole kind of, what you might call Islamic presence, was them rather than a different part of us in terms of Spanishness. Again, a lot of the kind of Reconquista argument would see medieval history in terms of an intrusion from outside. If you like, there can be good intrusions. The Visigoths are an acceptable intrusion, whereas the Muslims, Arabs and Berbers, are a bad intrusion and never become properly Hispanic. They are, if you like, occupiers. I mean, we have a bit of the same kind of thing, if you like, in the way in which the history of Scotland has been looked at by nationalists. There are good invaders and bad invaders. The Romans are bad, the Anglo-Saxons are bad, whereas the Vikings are deemed to be settlers and if you like, become us. So it's not a peculiarly Spanish problem, this one, but the Spanish example of Reconquista really, if you like, represents the essence of it, that it's seen as a recovery of what has been lost, that those who came in and, if you like, stole most of the land and suppressed the culture and the Christian development of the Iberian Peninsula are eventually, as a result of a succession of campaigns and with mixed success, but ultimately resulting in the final stage, the conquest of Granada by Fernando and Isabel in 1492. And then, of course, it all also leads on to the subsequent expulsions of Jews and Moriscos. So in that sense, yeah, I suspect a lot of people now would deliberately try to avoid using the term. It's useful when you're talking about in terms of the kind of, what you might say, the intellectual construct, the modern idea, and trying to understand its role in 19th and 20th century historiography. But as a way of looking at the history of the medieval centuries, I think it's definitely, put it mildly, it gets in the way. It gives a false impression of what was happening, and indeed makes the, if you like, everything in terms of conflict between two sides, whereas a lot of research has been devoted recently to looking at the ways in which different rules operate, that frontier societies can actually be much, as it were, more integrated and less confrontational, the way in which, for example, Christian mercenaries and others fight for Muslim rulers and vice versa. So the image of two sort of confronting societies, two civil, different antagonistic civilizations, again, has been sort of largely and rightly challenged. So I personally, I think, yes, Reconquista needs to be sort of seen. I mean, there's no point saying, well, don't use the term, because it's very interesting to use it when you're looking at the history of, as well, the historiography of Spanish medieval and indeed more widely Iberian medieval history. But it's not a, as I say, a sensible way of looking at the period that it's supposed to refer to.
Okay, that is extremely interesting. I did some reading on it, and if I understood correctly, it seems like in the medieval mindset, it was seen more as a restoration. The mission was restoration and not necessarily reconquest. Could you explain what the difference would be within the medieval mindset versus the modern mindset?
Well, I suppose part of, when you say sort of restoration, part of this is of course, again, it's historiography. It's the way in which the processes of territorial expansion were justified, even from the very sort of earliest phase. I mean, after the Arab conquest and the emergence of sort of residual small Christian states in the north, the very earliest historiography produced in what became the Kingdom of the Asturias, describes how one of the earliest kings, Alfonso I, I have to interject here that actually at that stage they weren't actually kings and didn't use the title. That probably doesn't occur until the very beginning of the next century, the 9th century. But shall we say, one of the earliest Asturian rulers, Alfonso I, is described in chronicles that are written a bit later, in fact, in the sort of later 9th, early 10th centuries. He's described as having created a sort of cordon sanitaire by moving the population out of basically the Duero, the Douro Valley, and leaving a sort of desolate zone between his new state and the Muslim rulers in Al-Andalus. And there's a lot of kind of historiographical argument, again, mainly in the 20th century, about the reality of the depopulation of the Duero Douro. And again, it's now largely accepted that this is a historical myth, that it never actually happened, that yes, some people no doubt did flee across the mountains to refuge in the north, and indeed may have, if you like, gone there and back again more than once. But the idea that somehow that this territory was depopulated and its entire population moved north to help kind of create the new kingdom of the Asturias, which I say indeed wasn't a kingdom at the time, is a myth, probably intended to justify the subsequent reoccupation of that area by Alfonso's descendants, particularly in the time of Alfonso III at the very end of the 9th century, when indeed this historiography was being composed. And similarly, in the centuries that follow, although Spanish historical writings in the Middle Ages are in many cases a bit arid when compared with the sort of substantial and florid narratives you find in, say, English or French medieval historical narratives and chronicles, a lot of it is really aimed at justifying what is happening, that, you know, sort of saying, well, our ruler is the, if you like, the heir, the inheritor of the Visigothic kings, and indeed they, in some cases, create a sort of spurious genealogy to link the line of the kings of Asturias, León, Castile, to some of the last kings of the Visigothic period, thus, if you like, making them blood descendants as well as heirs in a legal sense, and they are really recovering what is their own. In part, if you like, this is, I suspect, a kind of a narrative to, shall we say, encourage the conflict, but it's also, of course, to provide some kind of legal justification for why. You might think, well, if you just conquered a bit of territory, then why do you need to have a justification for having done so? But actually, the medieval mind, not least, is extremely sort of law-minded. And in that sense, the presentation of arguments for why this was a recovery of the, shall we say, of the rights of a long-dispossessed heir, and indeed a succession of heirs, to what they should have, as it were, as a right inherited, is an important part of the self-presentation in successive historical writings, say the Asturian Chronicles, the writings of Jiménez de Rada in the 13th century, and then on into the kind of chronicle tradition that's initiated by Alfonso the Wise. So, as I say, at what level this was understood, or shall we say, interested the wider population, I don't know. This is, if you like, a kind of elite process. I don't think this was a kind of motivating force for the participants. I don't think they were kind of being inspired, sort of thinking, you know, we must go and as it were, slay the Paynim foe because we're trying to recover the rights our king had to the lands that his, as it were, 20 times great grandfather once owned. It's far more sort of, as it were, at a kind of intellectual and elite level. And as I say, I don't think that this kind of idea of the recovery of rights and lands and property lost in the very beginning of the 8th century was in itself a strong motivational force centuries later. But it was part of an important ideological as it were, justification for what was happening. And it's not just the, if you like, the Asturian Leonese Castilian line. Similar sort of historiographical arguments develop in, not least in Aragon and Catalonia.
So this isn't anything comparable like the crusading fever that swept Europe, you know, sometime afterwards, where, you know, we have to go and get the infidel or expel the infidel or anything like that. So at the time, you're saying this is really a slow process that's happening on the ground, but only at the higher levels are justifications being created.
That's it. And indeed, I think, you know, the point you make about the Crusades is an important one. I don't think that you find in Spain, certainly, shall we say, in the indigenous society, anything like that degree of, and then interestingly, of course, you don't get Spanish participation in the main Crusades, and the actual sense of sort of a crusading process within Spain is largely the result of particularly French and sort of Northern European contingents involving themselves at various stages in some of the campaigns in the time of the Crusades, and obviously there you've got the benefit of the papal crusading bulls and the various promises of celestial reward or loss of punishment that these contain. And quite often, of course, these French and as it were, non-Hispanic participants were a frightful nuisance because they didn't, if you like, know the ground rules by which local society operated. They indeed did think they were there just to massacre Muslims and indeed anybody else who seemed a bit unusual on the way, and were not easily kind of diverted and made to understand exactly what the Spanish Hispanic Christian rulers wanted. Well, indeed, in some cases, they didn't have much choice. These people were coming, led by warlords from beyond the Pyrenees, with very strong ideas of what they were going to do and what they were there for, and not particularly willing to be dictated to by the Hispanic rulers. So, as I say, in that sense, although this is a zone of almost continuous, well, with periods of tranquility, but I mean, to a much greater degree than most other parts of Europe, this is an area of conflict, religious in part, but I mean religious in terms of the way it could be presented. The actual crusading ideal is not really a Hispanic one at all. I mean, it's papal, and it becomes a sort of sideshow for the Western European crusaders who didn't want to go all the way to the Eastern Mediterranean. They could find an alternative closer to home, go and make a nuisance of themselves, and then go home feeling that they'd done a good day's job, good day's work, or several months' work, and probably with some loot on the side.
So, speaking of the church, does the Catholic Church play a big role in the propagating of the idea of Reconquista? Do they have a hand in this at all, or is this more of a political project on the part of the rulers?
Well, of course, if you're talking about Reconquista, as it were, capital letters and inverted commas, whatever, then we're talking about the Franco period and the, as it were, alliance of church and state in that period. But going back to the medieval, obviously, as in with other Western European kingdoms, there was various kinds of friction between the, as it were, the ecclesiastical establishment and the secular rulers. But by and large, shall we say, the indigenous church was far more supportive of the local rulers, even to the extent of not quite ignoring the instructions that came from Rome, but delaying implementing them or doing so only fairly half-heartedly, and various legates had to be sent at different points to try and encourage more of the approved behaviour, shall we say, as seen by successive popes. Obviously, there are certain periods in which Christian rulers inside the Iberian Peninsula are looking for outside assistance, particularly in the case, for example, of Sancho the Great of Navarre and also Alfonso VI of Leon Castile, looking for external assistance and therefore being, shall we say, rather more willing to adopt the kind of the norms imposed by the papacy and sort of papally approved practices, in, for example, in monasticism, and hence, of course, the abolition of the what's called the Visigothic or Mozarabic liturgical rite, and also the final disappearance of the traditional script and other various features that had marked out the Spanish Church for centuries, and also the importing of non-Hispanic clergy to many of the most important dioceses, for example, Toledo, in the aftermath of Alfonso's capture of it in 1085. It was felt that French clergy were necessary to oversee the kind of changes, again, often causing internal conflict in their diocese with their own clergy. So it's a complicated picture. There used to be a sort of idea that somehow or other, going back indeed to the Visigothic period, that Spain was kind of cut off from the other parts of Western Christendom, or indeed didn't communicate, that there was virtually no contact. I'm looking back now really in the pre-1000 period, which is not necessarily true. I mean, the idea that somehow it was an entirely sort of independent and deliberately, as it were, obstructionist local church, ignoring the influence of Rome, I think is, again, this is a sort of nationalist idea that got promoted. But on the other hand, I think you have to look at the questions of evidence. For example, we have so little surviving papal correspondence that there's virtually none of it relating to Spain is not necessarily proof that it didn't exist. It's merely that it doesn't now exist, but not that it never existed. And as I say, there are other sort of more positive features you can point to say that actually, while maintaining their own independent traditions, the churches in the Iberian Peninsula before the Gregorian reforms of the late 11th century was not as isolated and not as kind of irredentist as is sometimes made out.
That's extremely interesting, because I did have the impression that the church institutions of Northern Iberia at the time did have contact, but not necessarily a lot of contact with the Church of Rome. And so whenever there was reforms, like when it was being helped or even pushed by the Franks, from what I had read, it seemed like those were kind of just being drip-fed into northern Spain, while Andalusi Christians were barely getting any of that. Is that an accurate assessment or not quite so?
No, I think not. I think, again, this was the impression that certainly was sort of one strongly held, and indeed in some cases sort of deliberately promoted. But individual bits of evidence, for example, you know, you've got to see this against a background of extraordinarily limited evidence. And therefore, so when you find small as or counterexamples, then they have to be taken seriously. I mean, but there are a number of cases, for example, in the Asturias, that the evidence would suggest that there was much, which again, if you like, is also reflected and indeed is partly dependent on kind of economic contacts. I mean, although trade from the eastern Mediterranean to, shall we say, the British Isles, comes virtually to a halt in the early 7th century, there's a lot of archaeological evidence showing continuing, more localized trade links between northern Spain, western France, and the British Isles. And on the back of that, you know, if you've got ships toing and froing, then you've also got means of communicating in other ways. I mean, as it were, individuals, also letters. And I mean, just look at the letter of Alfonso III of the Asturias to the monks of Tours when he's trying to buy a crown that he believes that they have, which they've been given probably by the Frankish king, Charles the Bald. And they were in, as it were, some financial difficulty because of Viking depredations, which included the recent sacking of the Basilica of St. Martin. And it's a fascinating and extraordinary survival, this one letter, because he describes the way in which, as it were, communication was taking place envoys are going to and fro, and he is taking advantage of this to send them, if you like, an offer that he would happily take this crown off their hands in return for, as it were, suitable financial recompense. And that he also refers to a number of kind of local nobles, some of the if you like, the local aristocracy in the Loire Valley. So, I mean, he's clearly very much more informed. And similarly, I mean, exactly the same route you find almost 200 years earlier, the extraordinary survival, again, just as a matter of chance, I mean, of the letter of Alcuin to Beatus, the Asturian abbot, an author of the famous commentary, of which many illuminated manuscripts survive, which again refers to how Alcuin, who is now himself based in Tours, was delighted to encounter somebody who'd come from the Asturias and was going to use the opportunity to send this lengthy letter back to. So, as I say, although this is just, if you like, a couple of cases, and I couldn't cite many more, but it shows that these kind of links existed, and indeed it's quite clear to see, as I say, from the economic evidence, how they could have persisted, not necessarily with, as it were, equal strength. I mean, clearly there were various factors that, such as the, if you like, the period of Viking destruction on the sort of Western French seaboard, which may have made travel far more dangerous and perhaps rather less frequent. But as I say, the north of Spain was much more open. And similarly, if you look down at the, as I'm moving to the south, when you look at some of the, I mentioned the commentaries of Beatus, and there's some extraordinarily interesting, I mean, one of them in particular has a feature of one of its illuminations that is clearly linked to a French, as it were, a tradition of design. And you know, you wouldn't have expected this, but there it is. There is evidence of some kind of artistic influence. So how it came about, I don't know, because, I mean, this, the particular scriptorium in which this one example I'm thinking of was produced, you know, we know nothing about really as to its, shall we say, wider sort of cultural links. But there is the evidence of the, as it were, the influence, however it came. It may have been in different stages. And further south, of course, down into the Christian, as it were, the Christian population of Al-Andalus. And I suspect this isn't, again, perhaps widely understood, but we're talking, when you look at the Christians of Al-Andalus, certainly in the Umayyad period, and indeed possibly for a bit after, they're probably still the majority population in that area. They're not, as it were, a tiny and diminishing population. It's only in somewhere like Cordoba that you may well have had a majority Muslim population by the end of the 10th century, not more widely. So, you've got a quite a different canvas. And at the same time, although some of the connections of the Southern Christians with their, if you like, their Northern equivalents have been lost, there is much more contact with Christians in North Africa. Again, there's a much longer survival of Christian population there, and even more so with Egypt and other parts of the Eastern Mediterranean. So although it can look like a kind of isolated and rather introverted world, there are enough little bits of evidence put against the backdrop of limited survival of evidence in any case to suggest that this is not quite as cut off and insulated as is, has long been thought.
Okay, so switching gears, we can now get into the question of the legacy of the Visigoths in Iberian history. When I first started my show and I covered the Visigoths in one episode, I figured, you know, this is pretty much going to be it. There'll be some legacy. But I was honestly surprised to see how deeply entrenched Visigothic religious practices and cultural practices and political practices carried on throughout centuries later. So I was wondering if you could speak a little bit to that as to how deep, how long, and why did it last so long?
Right. I suppose you have to really start by saying that the term Visigoth, Visigothic, can be a bit of a delusion. We're talking more about a period than a people. There's a danger, and again, this was a distinction that was largely ignored. There's a danger of sort of seeing somehow that there's a whole sort of population of Goths, Visigoths, as it were, wild people from emerging out of the area north of the Danube, and indeed possibly, according to some of the sort of late Roman ethnographers, beginning their existence in Scandinavia, and then arriving rather sort of hairy and destructive, making their way across various parts of Western Europe, sacking Rome into Gaul, and then coming and basically conquering Spain. That, is, as it were, is a really crude way of looking at some of the events of two or three centuries earlier. That in the period of the Visigothic kingdom, as we would see it, I mean, we're talking about sort of a difference of 200 to 300 years. I mean, the majority of the population, indeed, perhaps the great majority of the population, will basically have been the Hispano-Roman population, mixed in with some elements who, if you like, migrated into the peninsula in the sort of final stages of the late Roman Empire. But they're, if you like, creating a new identity. Again, this is why I kind of always have to put in proviso about the use of Visigoth. That's not a term that was used at the time in the Iberian Peninsula. Where you find reference to Visigoths, it's either outside the peninsula or after 711, that at the time, in the period between, shall we say, sort of 450 and 711, what you see is the emergence of a Gothic identity, essentially a new people. I mean, it's a term that has been around, but they are very much like the Franks in Western France, creating a new post-Roman identity. It's an ethnic identity, with, as it were, actually quite shallow historical roots. I mean, it's very interesting when you look at Isidore's historical works, you know, his History of the Goths. He only goes back to the very end of the 4th century, the sort of pre-crossing of the Danube period isn't there. And none of that clearly mattered. As I say, the new identity that's being forged in the Iberian Peninsula, really in the 6th and 7th centuries, it's a combination of various elements, including, if you like, others from coming in from the south. It gets cut off by the Arab conquest. This is why, if you like, we don't talk about the inhabitants of the Iberian Peninsula today as Goths, which might, we might otherwise have done. It seems a strange idea. But in the way that we talk about the French, clearly, if you like, relating to the Franks and similarly the English and like with the Angles, Anglo-Saxons, something similar could have happened in the Iberian Peninsula, but it didn't. And I say that's largely as a result of the overthrow of the kingdom and the... but in the meantime, in that period, that sort of post-Roman period in the Iberian Peninsula, an awful lot was achieved. The society that emerged, as I say, you need to forget the kind of distant roots or the supposed distant roots. It's something that, if you like, is indigenous, that is being created on the spot in the peninsula from various elements. It produces a number of very important, we might call sort of heirloom elements, such as a substantial body of ecclesiastical law, a substantial body of civil law. And these are transmitted together with a large body of theological and other writings, patristic, as it were, late patristic authors like Isidore, the various bishops of Toledo who've left writings. Not everything that they wrote has survived, but a surprising amount of the literary composition of the 7th century church in Spain was transmitted. And some of it, particularly works of Isidore, if you like, are already transmitted beyond the Visigothic kingdom in the 7th century. I mean, works of Isidore are appearing in Francia and indeed in Ireland and get into Northern Britain too. So there's, if you like, an intellectual legacy and a legal legacy, both secular and ecclesiastical. And also, of course, you have in the history, which of course is not anything like as well described as, say, comparable Frankish history, where you've got for the 6th century, you've got the, as well, the 10 books of history of Gregory of Tours. And we would sort of think, oh, if only we could have had something comparable to that, you know, some really substantial narrative histories. The problem is with Gregory of Tours is that he's almost too good. He was very idiosyncratic, wrote very much, as it were, according to his own prejudices, and created an image of Merovingian society that makes it seem like a kind of wild frontier society. And indeed, for a number of other reasons, Merovingian history tended to be rather kind of treated as shall we say, far more sort of primitive and savage than was the case. But in the Visigothic kingdom, we lack, and indeed, if you like, we regret, but there are compensations, the kind of detailed who did what to whom type of narratives. But what we do have is an enormous amount of material about the, as it were, normative material about how things should be conducted, how legal and administrative practices should be carried out. And also we had a unified kingdom, which again is not something, for example, you find amongst the Franks, but they tended to divide their kingdom into sort of subsections. But there is this extraordinary fact that between the late Roman Empire and the present, the Iberian Peninsula was only ever, with a brief exception of a 60-year period, you know, in the end of the 16th century and up to 1640, there was no unified political authority in the Iberian Peninsula, say, between Rome and the present, and indeed that continues to be the case. So the Visigothic kingdom was the only time in which there was, even if it extended across the Pyrenees and in a smaller extent in southwestern Gaul, the only time when the Iberian Peninsula was unified under a single political authority, the Gothic kings, even if they had all sorts of problems to face and whatever, that created, if you like, a kind of, it wasn't something that was much, as it were, commented on at the time, but for subsequent generations, it was something that could look back to and see, if you like, this, a peninsular monarchy. I mean, they weren't able to recreate it because, as we know, if you like, Leon Castile, Portugal, Aragon, all emerge, as it were, competing for control of different parts of the peninsula. But the if you like, the Gothic model, the ideal of a united peninsula was something that it was created in the Visigothic period and was something to which later generations could sort of turn and present as I already said, I mean, that they were using this as a justification anyway for what they were doing. But there was this sort of sense that it might be possible to one day bring about the restoration of peninsular unity. So there's an enormous amount of material, some of it practical, some of it what might call ideological ideas, some represented in texts, some, if you like the idea of the unified kingdom, more represented in the mind than in sort of treatises and literary texts. So it's really this that gets handed on. It takes a while. I mean, it used again to be sort of thought that there was a kind of direct link between the Visigothic kingdom and the Asturian kingdom. And as I said, actually, the Asturian kingdom per se doesn't become a kingdom until the 9th century. And the whole kind of rediscovery of the Gothic roots and the Gothic, if like, ideology as a means of both of justifying and inspiring conquest really only emerges, as I say, in the time of Alfonso III in the late 9th century. And it's not necessarily, shall we say, a consistent theme thereafter. There are various points at which the Gothic legacy is, as it were, brought out and polished and shown off. Other periods in which it matters rather less. Though at a practical level, in terms of the church, I mean, obviously the liturgy continues. I mean and as does the law. Though of course that starts to as it were, be altered for practical reasons with the fueras and the introduction of more kind of localized lawmaking to deal with particular local conditions. But the actual body of the fuero juzgo, or lex visigothorum, just as a concept of a great sort of national body of law, is a very powerful one, even though, as I say, it's practical application probably varied a lot, and much of it was probably entirely irrelevant, as indeed was some of the liturgical material that continued to be. For example, there's a manuscript from late 10th, 11th century Albelda in the Rioja, which includes copying liturgical texts, includes a service for the reconciliation of Donatists. There were never any Donatists in the Iberian Peninsula at all. The Donatists are a form of North African schismatic who disappeared in the 6th century. But this particular, as it were, text obviously was introduced into the Visigothic kingdom by migrating clerics from North Africa, of which there were many, and then got, if you like, included in the service books and continued to be copied, as they say, right up to the 10th or 11th centuries, even though anybody who looked at it would say, well, who are the Donatists? When are we likely to encounter one of them? But, you know, the important thing was the tradition. You carried on because this is what you had inherited, and which, if you like, gave you your own sense of particular identity and worth. So I think the actual sort of the Gothic myth, indeed it is largely a myth, also needs to be seen alongside the rather sort of diverse practical legacy of law and ecclesiastical law too, which again, the utility of some of this ecclesiastical, you know, the councils. I mean, yes, it may be that something would crop up and therefore you would need to kind of look at the councils and you say, ah, yes, you know, the Council of Ankara ruled that. But a lot of it would never have been needed in a practical way, but you had it. This was, if you like, a great sort of ongoing tradition, a body of text to which you could refer and which again gave you that sort of sense of that you were going in the right direction.
An impression that I got was that as far as the Gothic religious legacy is that it endured or was seen as more important in Al-Andalus. Is that correct that they clung on to that Visigothic tradition a bit more as a sense of preserving their identity? And in the north, the changes came a little bit quicker. Is that an accurate view?
I think probably not, in the sense that, again, this is an image that I think was sort of widely presented. I mean, partly we don't know very, very much about, as it were, Christian society in Al-Andalus in terms of, if you like, the kind of intellectual activities. There may or may not be a small survival of liturgical texts from the south. There's an argument about certain manuscripts in Toledo where there are clearly two liturgical traditions coinciding, one of which, it's argued, may represent a survival of practices in the south. But again, that is merely a rationalization of the existence of the two versions. So we don't know a lot about that, but there are some things we do know about. For example, the survival of some of the kind of manuscripts, if not themselves, but copies made from them, but which those who've studied them from paleographic and textual points of view have led them to suggest that these are copies of manuscripts that originated in the South. Say very few of them actually themselves. There are one or two that probably were, but by and large, it's more that they were the kind of originals that was subsequently copied, but have distinctive features that have. So we do know something about the, if you like, the intellectual culture of Andalusi Christianity, and yes, not surprisingly, it is rooted in what had gone before in the Gothic period, but so is the most of the Christian practices in the north until you get, I mean, you know, change starts obviously with the Frankish presence in the very sort of northern edges of Catalonia and the introduction of Caroline script, so that the old so-called, again, Visigothic or Mozarabic script is gradually replaced, moving from east to west. And so in that sense, ultimately, Portugal, as the furthest removed, may retain some of the kind of textual elements and liturgical elements longer than other parts. And there are various forces we described before, the, as it were, investiture controversy, or the Gregorian reforms of the late 11th century, and the kind of pressure put on the peninsular rulers to conform to Roman norms and practices. But I don't think really that there's reason to, I mean, it could be suggested, of course, that the Christians in the South were more open to new influences from outside, from, shall we say, other Christian societies under Islamic rule. I mean, for example, there do seem to be, in just liturgical terms, there seem to be some borrowings from the Coptic Church. And these probably, therefore, if you like, didn't make their way all the way through up into the north. So there would have been gradual difference, but it's not necessarily because the, if you like, Christianity in Al-Andalus was fossilized or unreceptive. It probably was being subjected to influences from outside, as was the case in the Christian communities in the north as well. So it's a much more sort of mobile and complex picture. And I say the idea somehow that the Mozarabs were somehow sort of isolated and a bit backward is probably to be resisted.
I think that perhaps we can get to some listener questions at this point, so we can keep things within our time frame. Okay, so I have the first question here. What would be the most surprising single or little-known event that impacted or turned the tide, quote-unquote, during the time period in discussion? So I would say between 711 and 976, up until the death of Al-Hakam II. Is there a little-known event or something that sticks out to you that you would say this made a huge difference, it turned the tide in some kind of way?
A tricky question, but I wonder, I mean, just looking at, shall we say, the human element, this is a bit like, if I can jump ahead with a parallel to what I'm about to describe. You know, if you go to Avila, not to the cathedral, but the church there, in which the tomb of the only son of Isabel of Castile and Fernando of Aragon, who died at the age of 19 in 1497, and he was the Infante Juan. And you kind of look at that tomb and you think, well, if he'd survived, if he had gone on, and indeed he had just married, and indeed a child was about to be born, but who unfortunately died in infancy. But if he had survived and had reigned, shall we say, for the next 20, 30 years longer, the Habsburg connection might never have happened, that Spain would not have been drawn into all of those wars in Italy and Central Europe. All of that, as it were, loot or the resources removed from Central and Southern America to Spain, but which then got funneled into maintaining the, shall we say, the Habsburg sort of enterprises, would not have gone in that direction. Heaven knows what could have happened. as I say, a Spain that was not a Habsburg Spain might have been a very different place. So I think using that, if you like, as a kind of parallel, my answer to the question would be that possibly the most surprising or momentous outcome of a, what might call a human accident, was indeed at the very end of the period you just outlined. The fact that Al-Hakam II died, leaving only two sons, both of whom were minors. And for the first time in the entire history of the Umayyad dynasty in the Iberian Peninsula, a ruler, as it were, succeeds without being able to exercise power in person. And the result is effectively the dictatorship of Al-Mansur, which in, as it were, immediate military terms, of course, is spectacularly dramatic. And the campaigns that he launches, I mean, really represent the most successful and dramatic the military ventures from the rulers of Al-Andalus, certainly since the probably the late 8th century. But the consequences for the kind of political stability of the caliphate, of the successors of Al-Mansur and their attempt basically to replace the Umayyad dynasty, or the suggestion that this is what the second of them was actually going to do, leads to the most extraordinary collapse of this enormously powerful, very wealthy, apparently stable political entity, the caliphate and the society and culture that sustained it, and the fragmentation of Al-Andalus into something like 40 plus sort of micro parts in the course of the 11th century. So in that sense, and I mean, if you look back at the history of the dynasty, they tended to produce, as did most of the Islamic dynasties, they tended to produce lots of heirs. And in virtually every case, not only there were, shall we say, surplus and in some cases problems arising from having too many heirs, but they were all sufficiently, as it were, mature to be able to exercise rule from the moment that they succeeded, by whatever means, their predecessor. And this is the one point at which you have this minority rule. And as I say, it's hard to dissociate that from the ensuing sort of political equilibrium and the collapse of the following civil war, and the collapse of the and disappearance of the caliphate, something you would not have prophesied in 976.
Absolutely. That is a rather dramatic turn of events. We're about to jump into that on the show. I'm very excited to cover Al-Mansur because he's a fascinating character from everything that I've read, and terribly ambitious, to say the least. When did the Portuguese national identity first begin to manifest itself?
Because I think it's an interesting question, because I mean it's one that, if you like, is relevant more broadly across the whole of Western Europe. When does national identity as opposed to political affiliation really develop? I mean, this has been studied particularly in the case of England, where you see the beginnings in the 13th century, when, because although, if you like, in the Anglo-Saxon period, there was something of a unified kingdom for a very short period, but in the ensuing Norman Anglo Norman and Angevin periods, the rulers had extensive continental possessions and didn't see themselves. I mean, their title was, if you like, King of England or King of the English, but this was merely one of their titles, and their concerns were often much more strongly directed to some of their possessions in what we would later call France. But it's only in the 13th century you start to get the sort of sense in the sources that there is a distinctive English aristocracy emerging, whose main concerns — they may still have property and possessions elsewhere, but whose main concern is within the English kingdom, and who are criticizing the monarchs for having foreign favorites and if you like, having interests that run counter to those of the English kingdom. And so you can sort of trace this as it develops in the centuries that follow. And I think the same is true in France. So I think in the Iberian Peninsula, we probably must beware of assuming that the existence of a political entity, be it the county and then the Kingdom of Portugal or the Kingdom of Leon, Aragon, and so on, necessarily represents a sense of a national identity. The existence, I mean, a successful monarchy of these kinds can actually help generate a national identity, but it's not the product of a national identity. So I would say in the case of Portugal, I don't know how much work has been done on this, but that a real Portuguese identity is going to be somewhere further down the line than the emergence of the Kingdom of Portugal. You know, when you look at the early history of the Kingdom of Portugal, it's a very artificial construct. You know, why on earth does it not include Galicia? If you like, in linguistic cultural terms, the two go together. The county of Porto is actually a sort of southern extension of Galicia. And indeed, the same aristocratic families are responsible, if you like, for the development of both. But as a result of the lack of a successor, of a male successor to Alfonso VI, the arrangement, as you know, takes place of the creation of a, as it were, a Portuguese. Well, it's not yet a kingdom, but it's something for Alfonso's second daughter, while his surviving daughter is as it were linking with Alfonso of Aragon. But out of that, the then does emerge over time that the very strong distinctive sense that what was initially an artificial construct, and like all of the other peninsular monarchies, you know, it kind of extends south by conquest as a result of you know, being hedged in by powerful neighbors, but with opportunities for expansion against the Muslim powers in the south. Out of that emerges a very strong national identity, which is certainly apparent in the 14th century. But as I say, it'd be interesting just to sort of, as I say, it may have been done. It's not something I know much about. But the process, I'm sure, could be traced somewhere between, as it were, the creation of the kingdom and the famous battle that represents the significant triumph of Portugal over Castile. So I think this is an interesting one to pursue.
You mentioned to me earlier that you are working on a new book. Can you tell us a little bit about it, and how soon can we expect to get it?
Don't start saving your money yet, but the book is to be intended to be, if you like, slightly controversial, The Christian Culture of Islamic Spain. And I'm really taking up a point I made in our discussions, that I want to explore the, shall we say, what I think is the reality of a much stronger and long-lasting Christian presence in Al-Andalus, which may well mean that the Christians provided the majority population, possibly into the Almoravid and even the Almohad periods. And in part by if you like, looking at the evidence, but in also looking at comparable societies. I mean, particularly, for example, Egypt, where it's much better documented, the survival of the Copts. People have rather jumped to conclusions based on largely sort of casual statements in, for example, Alvar's famous remark about the young effectively using Arabic rather than Latin, and it's somehow there's a danger. Historians faced with very limited evidence can latch on to small pieces and cling on for dear life and overinterpret them. And so it's been, for example, with that rather rhetorical statement. And interestingly, there is a virtually identical remark made in a Coptic source of virtually the same period, that, if you like, the young Christians are all speaking and reading Arabic, But as we know, the Coptic Church survives very effectively right through to the present. So the interpretation of this as a sign that Christianity was on its last legs and that the intellectual culture of the Christians in Al-Andalus was about to disappear, I say, never seemed very convincing to me. And I say there is actually plenty of evidence, not least in the form of inscriptions and Latin inscriptions going through into the 12th century, that even Latin, if you like, continues in a sort of privileged position, though probably most of the population would be speaking Arabic. But what I wanted to do was get away from ideas that somehow the Christians of Al-Andalus were not themselves, shall we say, very committed. They didn't understand much about their faith. They quickly gave it up. You know, the if you like, the pressures or inducements of conversion was. So I'm starting by looking at the nature of the Christian culture of the Visigothic kingdom to say, well, no, this is what they inherited. Then looking at the various arguments about the, as I say, the survival, the intellectual culture, reasons why Christianity eventually does decline in a diminishing Al-Andalus. And this also, of course, involves the survival in the north, both of Andalusi Christians who, if you like, get stranded as the political frontier moves south, but also others who take refuge in the north. Until you end up really just with the Mazarabs of Toledo in the later Middle Ages. And from that, I want to move on to look at the rediscovery of the evidence from the 16th century onwards, as the Spanish scholars, you know, starting with Ambrosio de Morales, recover the history and some of the literary products of the Christian communities of Al-Andalus. And then follow that through. I mean, this is going to have to be fairly rapid because I'm afraid the publishers won't let me have more than 120,000 words. Bring it through as far as I can to the present.
No, it's an endlessly fascinating topic, and there's a lot to be discovered and a lot more work to be done from everything that I can tell. So I'm happy to hear that you are on it. Like I said before, I do love your work. You're one of my principal sources thus far for my show.
Oh, thank you.
Absolutely. Any book that I can get of yours, I typically do. So I just want to thank you for all the work you've done over the years, because it's good stuff.
Oh, thank you. I got into it quite by accident. When I was starting research in Oxford back in 1971, my supervisor, Peter Brown, wanted me to work on Ennodius of Pavia and the kind of aristocracy of 5th century Italy. And I started that, and it was so dull. I'm afraid Ennodius, who was Bishop of Pavia in the Ostrogothic period, wrote this most appallingly kind of florid and almost incomprehensible Latin, and with very little real content. I mean, there are some of his works are interesting, but anyway, as I say, I wilted, and by the end of the first term, I wanted out and indeed Peter, for the two succeeding years, he got somebody else to work on the same topic. The second year, the same result, I have to say. The person, I'm afraid, I don't even remember their name. They abandoned and left Oxford and if you like, were never heard of again. In the third year, somebody else started, and well, she and I got married, and we're still together 51 years later. But as I say, there was no success. But anyway, in the meantime, as they were having decided that this particular topic wasn't for me, I started looking around at the end of this first term, and I read an article by E.A. Thompson on the conversion of the Goths from Arianism to Catholicism. And I thought, this is interesting, but I think it's wrong. I'll give myself a couple of weeks just to sort of find out why I think it's wrong and look into this. And anyway, I never stopped. So that kind of, by the end of that time, I was really hooked. I went to Spain for the first time and loved it. And then, as I say, remained going that way ever since. But it was purely accidental.
And you found your wife out of it, which is incredible.
Well, absolutely. Yeah, what more could you ask for?